Hello and welcome to Seeing Red, a true crime podcast. I'm Mark.
And I'm Bethan. Thank you for joining us once again. A huge thank you to Laura Burke for her case suggestion for this week's episode. Before we begin, I would like to address some comments and messages that we received recently following our episode, Season 11, Episode 2, A Devastating Quadruple Murder. So in this episode, we discussed the failings of probation service, which led to an incredibly dangerous man being placed wrongly in a home that resulted in the murders of Terry, her two children, John Paul and Lacey, and Lacey's friend, Connie. Part of my research into this case looked at Terry's mum, who had wanted to utilise Claire's Law to see whether her daughter's new partner, Damien Bendall, had more in his history than he had disclosed to them. She spoke to newspapers and stated that she changed her mind about submitting a Claire's Law, or Domestic Violence Disclosure Scheme request, as she found out that the results would be sent to her daughter, and this terrified her because she worried that Bendall would find out and that this could make life worse for her daughter. And I don't know if you remember, but we discussed in the episode how the idea of a letter or an email going to the home would indeed be potentially dangerous, devastating potentially. And we shared our thoughts on this process.
I looked it up after and I just kind of thought, is that definitely the case? And from what I could see, it was.
It's but really guessing, difficult because it doesn't not. Give you much information about it and how you get that information on the website unless you go further into it and you start making a request. It doesn't give you much. And we've since found out that what we discussed, the idea of a letter going to a home, is not the full story of a disclosure scheme request. A couple of our listeners shared some really important insights into this with us. We would absolutely hate, wouldn't we, Mark, for anyone to be put off about utilising the scheme based off of what we talked about. So here are a couple of the messages that we received from our listeners. So first of all, hello, listening to the most recent episode and wanted to give you a bit more information about Claire's Law. I think it's important for people to understand how the disclosure is given. Police will not give a disclosure in any written form. It should happen in person at a police station and the person who is informed doesn't get the information. It is read to them. They do not get a copy, so it wouldn't come through the post. At the police station, it gives people a safe place to disclose anything if they wish to. And there is lots of information about it online if you search Claire's Law. Anyone can apply and each application is assessed individually. The disclosure is only given to people who are in a relationship, want to start a relationship, or are having children with the other person. Please keep me anonymous. I love the show. So thank you very much for that message. And another read, hi, I just listened to your recent episode where you discussed Claire's Law disclosures, and I just wanted to add to this. I am a police officer for blah, 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 police force and give Claire's Law's disclosures frequently. These disclosures are not sent in the post, specifically because we understand that this is often where the risk is. The disclosures are given verbally in a safe place arranged at a suitable time and date for the victim and are arranged only using contact methods that they deem are safe, so email, etc. Sometimes this is with social workers also. We endeavour never to put the victim at more risk, and it might be worth sharing as it may encourage more people to do it. It can be a life-saving tool. Please don't use my name though, blah, blah, blah. So I did ask perhaps whether they had been disclosed by the post initially or previously, because that was what was insinuated by that newspaper report. And this police officer replied, I'm not entirely sure because I've only been doing them for 2 years, but I know in blah, blah, blah force, this is always the case now. I would imagine if it was received by post, it would put a lot of people off, but you weren't to know at all. It is such an underused tool and it would be great for more people to use it to keep safe. So we don't know for definite whether this was just really shoddy reporting from that newspaper to try and get headlines, I suppose. And, oh, you know, it was another reason why she didn't find out, whether the mum was misunderstood, whether this was the case before. I'm not sure.
Or it could have, like you say, it could have been misreported. But it's, you know, as far as I'm concerned, it's great to talk about it again and to set the record straight and be a bit clearer. And I did, as I was editing the episode, I was conscious of, is this definitely how it works? So I went onto the government website, started to submit a request just to kind of go through the motions of seeing what you need to do. And yeah, you're right, it's not overly clear, but it's great to be able to kind of give a bit more information about how this works.
Yeah, definitely. There were a couple of other comments that we did receive as well, all of them reiterating the same sort of thing. So thank you to anybody who reached out to us, because we always state, you know, we are just normal people with an interest in true crime doing this show. We aren't experts, but we also don't want to get things wrong or suggest things in the wrong way. especially when it's something this important.
Yeah, and I would attest to that fact. We are normal people, we're not experts, but we are very conscious that we've got, hate to use the word, a platform, and we've got tens of thousands of people listening to us every week. So we do know that there's a responsibility that comes with that. Even though we are just an amateur show and normal people with normal jobs that do this in our spare time, I totally get that we've got a responsibility there.
And also worth noting just on this is Sarah's Law, which relates to keeping children safe. It's very similar to Claire's Law. And that's actually prompted me to cover Sarah Payne's case soon. So that's going to be with our listeners in the next, probably next few months. But I thought that was actually a really good point as well. There's not, you know, all these laws come about because of absolutely horrendous things that happen to people, but they've got that legacy, which is just incredible. So let's say a huge thank you to our newest Patreon supporters, and then we're going to crack on with this week's case. Would you like to do the honours, Mark?
I certainly would. So we have Sarah Millman, Alice Patrick, Donna Mullins, Chloe Clapp, Hannah Brocklebank, Marilyn Gould, Rebecca Stratton Cox, and that's it. Thank you. I thought there was one more name. There wasn't. So thank you to all of you. If you would like to join these people, all you need to do is head over to patreon.com/seeingredpodcast. And we are so, so grateful for any and all support we get over there. It does mean, honestly, it means the absolute world to us, and it makes a huge difference as well. So yeah, please do have a think about it. Thank you.
Born into a troubled family, Amber and her brother Connor were moved out of their parental home and into care before being placed to live with a family. And they were just 3 and 5 years old at this point. Connor told his younger sister, "We are safe now." And that should be the end of this story, but of course it isn't. And my heart absolutely breaks for these children. They had suffered throughout their early childhoods. Throughout those formative years, they had endured abuse and violence, and they'd seen things that no child should ever see. The family they were placed with was a loving and kind one, and life really should have been happy from this point onwards. But just 13 short years later, Amber would be dead at the hands of a sadistic sexual killer. Photos show her smiling, happy and joyful, and she was incredibly a warm and trusting child, even though her short life had been a horrific catalogue of tragedy and misfortune. So what led Amber, aged just 16, to be murdered at the hands of someone she loved and trusted? Let's go right back to that beginning. 5-year-old Connor and 3-year-old Amber walked into their new foster home, and Connor said, "We are safe now," and their story seemed to have found this happy ending. They'd been placed with the Niven family after being removed from their family home, and their new foster parents were called Craig and Carol. They really wanted to help these children, and it truly seemed like they would be okay after all. The pair had left behind abuse and neglect, a father who would later be convicted of sexually assaulting 2 young boys and assaulting and raping a woman between 2001 and 2007. They left behind a home in which their mum was attacked by their dad. They left behind a home where they had life in squalor, having to steal food just to survive. And it's unthinkable that any child should have to grow up in such conditions.
Yeah, and it happens, and we hear about it so much, but you never really get immune to the shock of it, to hearing that, of a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old being brought up in absolute squalor, having to steal food in order to survive and being abused at the hands of their parents. And sometimes we get to see, unfortunately, the photos, don't we, of those home environments in which they're brought up initially before, you know, they're removed or before something catastrophic happens. And it's so shocking, you know, the squalor that they live in quite often. Yeah, anything involving children, it's so, so difficult to talk about, but we can't ignore these cases, and things can be learnt from them.
Yeah, they definitely can. And I think this is one of those where there's so much that can be kind of learned from this. So Connor and Amber's new home was in Larkhall in Lanarkshire in Scotland. So this is about 14 miles southeast of Glasgow. It's got views of the River Clyde and the Avon Water. And Larkhall is a typical west of Scotland industrial town with a history of mining, weaving and textiles. Larkhall also had its own iron and steel works, and it is home to the tallest viaduct in Scotland. So there's also some criminal history within Larkhall's past, when in 1999, a gas explosion took the lives of four people. So the case of Transco PLC and their failings resulted in the first ever prosecution for culpable homicide in Scotland with regards to a public limited company. And it's got nothing to do with this week's case, but I always find cases like that really fascinating. So I hope you and our listeners are going to forgive me if I briefly discuss what happened on the 22nd of December, 1999. So a routine police patrol detected a strong smell of gas in Carlisle Road in Larkhall, near to the home of the Findlay family. So Andrew, Jeanette and their children Stacey and Daryl lived in the bungalow and they were at home excitedly preparing for Christmas. Officers had alerted Transco, which had responsibility for the mains pipes delivering gas to the homes, and ordered them to seal off the area. But the warning came too late. There was a huge explosion and the bungalow was ripped apart. Four neighbouring homes were also damaged and the blast was heard up to 4 miles away. The family had no chance. They were all killed in the explosion. During the trial, the court heard how the mains were of a type known to be liable to corrosion called ductile iron, and following alerts in the 80s, the firm had by 1989 decided to replace such pipes with polyethylene. The Transco records for this area wrongly showed that the pipes in the area of the blast had been replaced with polyethylene ones, so this error led to the leaking of gas from the old ductile iron mains into the foundations of the Findlay's home.
Oh, that's so tragic, and that's, I mean, I think it's fair that somebody is held responsible for that, but it's, that is just a simple administrative error, and who could have ever foreseen that that would result in the death of this entire family?
Well, according to the court's Transco, to be honest, because it wasn't a simple error, it wasn't just one mislabeling. The whole case kind of looked at multiple errors, maintenance, repairs, record keeping procedures. So basically, the court's alleged that Transco failed to keep accurate records of its pipelines, including that iron main, which the company had noted was made of polyethylene, but it wasn't. They should have been on top of that. They should have been looking at maintenance of those pipes and repairs. And during the trial, the company actually attempted to blame an internal gas leak for the explosion. So that would have obviously absolved them of any responsibility. But actually, it was clear there was proof that the gas had leaked into the family's home from the corroding mains pipes. Those pipes were the responsibility of the company. And throughout the trial, the company was really slammed for kind of showing very little or no remorse for what had happened. They really were just trying to pass the buck the entire time.
Oh no, I take it all back then. So they were clearly pretty shit at pretty much all aspects of maintaining and repairing those pipes and keeping records of it. So yeah, that's terrible. And to show no remorse, you've got lawyers at the helm of that saying you can't, but it's unacceptable.
So after hearing 26 weeks of evidence and a week of legal submissions, the jury returned a guilty verdict, finding Transco guilty under health and safety legislation for failing to maintain the iron gas main, which ran through the Findlay's garden when it was extensively corroded and leaking. Transco was fined a record £15 million following the trial. Prior to this, the largest fine for an individual firm was the penalty imposed on Thames Trains after the Ladbroke Grove train disaster that we discussed a few weeks ago. And it's really, really quite terrifying when we hear of companies who are in charge of such important and very dangerous elements of our society not taking their responsibilities seriously. And I am grateful that there are so many more regulations on companies to ensure that they keep proper records and behave appropriately now, but it's not unheard of still.
No, of course it's not. And it's when you were saying we're in Scotland and there was this other case that you wanted to talk about and you mentioned that it was a gas explosion, I wondered if it was something offshore, because obviously there's a huge offshore industry around Scotland with oil rigs and stuff. And I know, for example, there's the Piper Alpha oil rig disaster, which is something I'm going to be covering at some point soon. And that's another...
because I've always had that on my... radar, so I will take that off my suggestions list.
And I know that was a while ago, and we've got things like the Marchioness disaster, which we've covered, which was in the 80s. But yeah, unfortunately, these things do still happen, and people very much criticise all of the red tape and the legislation around health and safety, but it is there for a reason. So I'm not, you know, lecturing people on it. I can understand the frustrations, but yeah, you kind of understand, don't you, why it has to be so stringent and so complex to ensure people are safer than they were perhaps in the 80s when it was a bit more relaxed.
Yeah. So back to 2007/2008 and Connor and Amber being placed with their new foster parents. So I haven't got an exact date of when this was. They were removed from the family home and then placed with this couple. So there was a bit of, you know, there were a few months difference between the two things happening. And life seemed to have turned a really happy corner for the siblings. This isn't the kind of story where the children are then taken from this home and passed to another place, place to place, not able to set down roots. These children remained with the Nivens, so from the age of 3 and 5 up to when they were young teenagers. So they were there for quite a while. And Craig and Carol were actually granted permanent care of the siblings a few years after taking them on initially. So it was a really stable and should have been a really stable place for them to grow up. I'm a huge supporter of foster care. The majority of foster carers are incredible people. I've got neighbours who are foster carers and they do this amazing job raising what I was going to say the young boys, but they're late teenagers now, the guys that they have taken in, and they just do an incredible job.
Yeah, it's such an important job as well. And you're absolutely right. The vast majority do a fantastic job, are in it for the right reasons. However, I do know anecdotally of people that have absolutely gone into it for the wrong reasons, for money, and do a really shit job of it. And I don't know those people firsthand, but I've heard of stories through other people. And that really pisses me off because,
yeah,
I think if you're going into it, it's a vocation, it shouldn't be for the wrong reasons. And I've heard of stories where the foster children are, you know, treated worse than their biological children and things like that. Yeah, hate all of that. You'll probably know who I'm talking about, Betham.
I do, yeah, because I've got a friend who grew up in a loving home where his parents fostered children, and he genuinely saw those other children as his new siblings. They were part of their home. They enriched his life. And I know exactly who you're talking about, where they actually call the other children the foster children rather than by their names. And it's all about how much money they will be gaining from having people living in the home, which is just so inappropriate. And there's always going to be even worse horror stories as well within the care system. But these are thankfully getting rarer and rarer these days. Abuse cases also kind of tend to refer to children within care homes rather than foster homes. Obviously, I'm not going to say bad things don't happen within foster homes. And, you know, a quick Google search will show cases. But I really wanted to make it clear here that Craig and Carol were not bad foster parents at all. They didn't have it easy with Amber and Connor, though. Both were affected by their upbringing, although I can't imagine anybody wouldn't be. We all know how important stability and care and love is for infants in order to grow up into mentally healthy children and mentally healthy adults. And we all know that traumas suffered in early childhood, whilst not always clearly remembered, will have a huge impact on brain development. So whilst Amber and Connor were brought into this loving home and they were nurtured, there were still challenges for the Nivens.
I think that's such a key point in this, isn't it? Because, and I think we've learned that through covering other cases, that lack of nurture and attention and affection and all of those things in very early childhood, talking sort of, you know, from 0 months to probably 2 years old, just shapes the future, and it has such a detrimental impact, doesn't it? Even if that child is taken out of that environment and put into a different family environment, adopted, whatever, it can still manifest in terms of lots of different problems later in life, which is just so sad that they've been given, you know, this chance, a great life, but unfortunately sometimes the damage has been done and it's irreparable sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Amber was later described as the most giving, loving, supportive and admirable young girl, and her loved ones had said that Amber had shown hints of great promise. Although she had experienced immense suffering, according to her loved ones, she harboured an amazing outlook on life and she loved art and singing. But Dad Craig later described how the pair were not a good mix when left alone with one another. So the foster parents actually never left them alone in a room together. For fear of what exactly, he didn't elaborate, but a later observation on the care system during an investigation highlighted that there was no recognised framework to bring agencies together to assess and manage young people who may be displaying harmful sexual behaviour. So that wording hints at what the Nivens were presumably worried about here. Reports by the care system in 2011 stated that Connor should be found alternative accommodation, but there was no evidence this was ever actually looked into, and so the siblings remained together with the Nivens. The siblings clearly had issues that continued to affect them throughout their school years, and I understand this, but researching this case, it feels as if there wasn't really enough done to support them with the traumas that they carried. It feels as though they were given a decent home, and that was kind of seen as just enough, that they're in a decent place now, and we can just leave them be. And it doesn't feel as if there was much done to have ongoing mental health support for them. And I may be wrong, because maybe it's just not been reported on, but I cannot find anywhere that they were, not mandated therapy or anything like that, but at least encouraged.
I mean, you would presume that social workers would still be involved and there would be other agencies involved, but equally, even just sort of 10, 15 years ago, it was still, it's very different, wasn't it? Even just a few years ago, it was different to how it is today in terms of understanding mental health and supporting young people and adults. So there probably was limited support for them, because that was just the norm back then.
Yeah. So for a time, they attended separate schools. So Amber went to her school that was about 25 miles away in West Lothian's Bathgate, and her brother attended a school in Blantyre in Lanarkshire, which was a secondary school for those with social, emotional and behavioural needs. Former school friends described him as a loner who was prone to sudden fits of rage. And one ex-classmate said later he would talk about killing other pupils, which, to be fair, I saw as an over-exaggeration. But looking back on it now, maybe the stuff he said wasn't exaggeration at all. As the children grew up, the effects of their early lives were still being felt, and at the age of 13, Amber was placed back into care. Connor remained with the Nivens until he turned 18, at which point he left home. And it's not really clear from the reports why Connor stayed and Amber left, but she went back into the care system and went to a children's home. And at the age of 16, she was living in a children's home in Hamilton. So that's a town about 5 miles from the home that she shared with the Nivens and her brother. And by the point in the story that this case takes place, Amber was 16. Connor had left the Nivens home at age 18 and was now living at a Hamilton homeless shelter. On the 26th of November 2021, Amber told staff at the children's home that she was going out to meet her brother for the evening. Staff tried to discourage this because they'd always been a bit uncomfortable about Connor's behaviour, but Amber refused to listen to their warnings or to their suggestions that she should stay at home, and instead she headed out with him. She was really excited to spend time with him, and Amber posted a selfie of the pair to friends on Snapchat with a caption that said, "My bro." She just really wanted to spend some time with Connor, just the two of them.
I think I can see where this is going, and it's so easy, isn't it, I guess, to look back and maybe see warning signs that weren't as obvious at the time. But yeah, it's understandable that she wants to go and see her brother. She's 16 years old. They're not living together at this point. And yeah, they've grown up largely.
He's the only constant,
isn't he? Yeah, they've largely grown up together. I know she's moved out in her teens back into the care system. But yeah, they would have a close relationship. And you're right. I think they've been through an awful lot together. So they're the only other person that knows what the other person has gone through. So yeah, you can understand that motivation to keep a relationship going.
Yeah. And you know what? That is what is the worst thing with this, is those two were the only ones who could fully understand the other person, what they'd been through, which just makes what happens next really, really horrendous. CCTV footage showed the pair walking together happily, and at around 10 p.m. they ended up at Cadzo Glen, which is a local nature reserve located in the centre of the town of Hamilton. What happened next is not fully known, although forensics gives a good indication, but the remaining CCTV footage from the night shows Connor walking back to the homeless hostel alone. Staff at the home where Amber lived reported her missing on the evening of the Friday the 26th of November. Her body was discovered in Cadzo Glen on the morning of the 28th of November, and Connor was arrested 3 days later. But what had happened in the time between the siblings heading out on their walk and Connor being arrested is really, really sickening. The pair were seen on CCTV at about 10 o'clock near Cadzo Glen, and about 90 minutes later, Connor was seen again on cameras, this time alone, At one point, he kind of leans up against a fence, looks like he's trying to catch his breath. He then kind of hurries back to the homeless unit where he was staying shortly before midnight. He goes out to some wheelie bins, carrying a plastic bin, goes back into the house. He's kind of spotted quite a lot doing different things. Connor told the police later that he'd been wearing a Ranger's top and camouflage shorts that evening, when in fact he'd been wearing a white top and grey shorts, and this was spotted on the CCTV quite easily. What he was throwing in that bin was the white top and grey shorts, and they were later found by the police in the bins. They hadn't been taken. The blood that was covering these clothes proved to be Amber's. So Amber's body, like I said, was discovered on Sunday the 28th of November, hidden in bushes and branches in Caso Glen, kind of covered in mud. Her clothes were found nearby, and the cause of Amber's death was compression of the neck. And forensics proved that Connor Gibson had removed his sister's clothing, sexually assaulted her with the intention of raping her, inflicted blunt force trauma to her head, her body, and then had strangled her. And he'd then left the glen and attempted to cover his tracks. Connor had even called the children's home to keep up the pretense that the pair had parted ways earlier on with no issue. So he'd even rung and tried to cover his tracks that way. Connor Gibson was questioned, but stated that he had nothing to do with Amber's disappearance. However, the evidence proved him wrong. Widespread blood staining on Connor Gibson's jacket was compatible with Amber, and his DNA was also found on her shorts that she had worn as underwear, which had been forcibly torn off. There was one other thing that the evidence also proved, however. After Connor Gibson had left poor Amber's dead body in the glen, she had been discovered by a member of the public. And this man, 45-year-old Stephen Corrigan, rather than alerting the police to the dead body he'd found, instead took it upon himself to touch Amber inappropriately and then concealed her body under leaves and branches.
We've heard of this before as well. This is like a thing. This isn't isolated.
What is with
this
people
happens.
Finding someone who is dead or dying and not just calling the police? What is with them then going on to touch inappropriately or abuse somebody? Like, what the hell is wrong with people?
That is as fucked up as what Connor has done. I'm sorry, but it is. It's just, and the thing is that it's minimal. They get minimal sentences for this. So even if a corpse is raped by somebody else who hasn't committed that murder, it's like 2-year sentence. It's absolutely ridiculous.
I mean, luckily here, he doesn't just get a 2-year kind of sentence.
Well, he's concealed
so
the body as well. So that, that is so slightly different. That's perverting the course of justice.
But I mean, the judge was so scathing of this as well. It was just, So Corrigan was later found guilty of attempting to defeat the ends of justice by intimately touching and concealing Amber's body after discovering her at some point in the 2 days between her murder and the police finding her, instead of contacting the emergency services. He wasn't known to either Amber or Connor. He also denied all the charges that were brought against him, saying he was at a complete loss to explain why his DNA was found on 39 areas of Amber's body, including her breasts, buttocks and thighs. You can't accidentally do 39 points of contact. That's ridiculous.
I think with this as well, it's because this is necrophilia, isn't it? And we've talked about it before.
Yeah.
And I remember when we did the episode on David Fuller, which I reference quite a lot because it's just one of those cases that stayed with me. It was just horrible. So if you don't remember that, he was a guy. He murdered 2 women at separate times in the 80s, got away with that, then went on to work in 2 hospitals in Kent from the 90s onwards and spent decades raping corpses in the morgues of those hospitals and getting away with it because he was a maintenance worker there. He had free access to the morgues. He would hook up a TENS machine to his genitalia and to the bodies. He was just utterly despicable.
Sick.
Sick is absolutely the word. But I remember when we covered his case and we talked about necrophilia, which we'd not really covered much before, and I'd done quite a bit of research on it, and I hate to kind of say it, but it's one of those things that is, whether people act upon it or just have those thoughts, it's much more common than you would like to think. So it's not like 1 in a million people would derive sexual gratification from a corpse, having sex with a corpse. It's much more than that. It's, I don't know what the stats are, but I looked at some studies and it was an alarming, that, you know, they managed to get some sort of data, and it was quite worrying that, I can't remember what it was, 1 in 100 or something like that. It was just like, whoa, what the fuck? So I think this is why this happens when people find dead bodies. This is why this happens, because it's an opportunity for them to engage in that, and it's much more common than we think.
Yeah. And I guess also because this isn't someone who's alive. I mean, this guy wouldn't have known whether she was alive or dead, really, if he'd stumbled across her quite early on. I don't know, or there's no proof of what time it was. But I guess it's also you've kind of done something that you then can't call the police and say, well, I've just found this, because you're then going to be questioned yourself. So then you make it much, much worse as well. I don't understand it at all. So Corrigan did have an alibi in the form of his dad. His dad told the court his son was at his home in Blantyre in South Lanarkshire that weekend after a fall on ice left his arm in a sling. He denied lying to protect him, but he did apparently state he couldn't confirm for definite that he'd been home the entire time. Because we've talked about this before, haven't we? You might be in the same home as someone, but when you're asleep, you don't know what someone else is doing. The dad might have had a nap in front of the telly for half an hour, or had been upstairs, and you don't know for definite that the person downstairs is actually in the house the whole time.
No, of course.
You know, his son was home.
You don't know what anybody's up to in your house, particularly in the night if one person's asleep. And it always reminds me, I think you watched it, Broadchurch, the first series.
Yeah. Oh, amazing. Olivia, I remember discussing that with you. Olivia Colman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But her character, her and her husband and her family had come back from a holiday, I think in Florida, jet lagged. She took a sleeping pill that night, went to sleep, and her husband went out and murdered a boy during the early hours of the night. And obviously she wasn't aware of that because she'd taken a sleeping pill. She was in a deep sleep.
Wasn't she a police officer as well?
Yeah, she was a fucking police officer.
She was a police officer, wasn't she? So everyone was like really judgy. But it's like, well, you were asleep.
I think this is it. You don't know what...
Yeah.
If you know, even if you're sleeping in the same bed as someone, if you're in a really deep sleep, they absolutely could go out and be doing unsavory things. Yeah.
And I also think as well, like if I say to my other half, like, oh, I'm just nipping to the shops, the time it takes me to walk to our local shops and walk back, I could have driven somewhere further away and he wouldn't have known. He'd have, you know, I'd probably get caught on some sort of AMPR or CCTV or something driving my car. But my other half would be at home thinking I'd just popped to the shops and that's why I've taken 10 minutes. But in that 10 minutes, I could have driven further. So you just don't know when you give someone an alibi, unless you were literally doing a three-legged race where you're tied together. I don't know why that's my example of why you
I don't think
tied
anyone's
together.
Ever had that.
Can see
that
my
is
innocence
the perfect
there.
Alibi. That is the perfect alibi, though. Or if you're a conjoined twin and your twin can verify where you were.
Exactly.
So be a conjoined twin and that will work.
There you go. If you're going to commit a crime, be a conjoined twin. Luckily, in this case, the forensic evidence was enough to convict Corrigan. And he was actually jailed for 9 years for interfering with Amber.
It could be that the law is different in Scotland, so it could be that sentencing is slightly different. But there is also the added element here of concealing the body as well, which would have been taken very seriously.
Yeah. So the judge told him he had been convicted of horrific crimes. And he said to Corrigan, coming across a young woman who had been strangled to death, she was naked. Instead of alerting the authorities, you decide to handle her body all over from head to toe, including areas that were intimate. Private parts, and your DNA told the story. So I'm so glad that the DNA was able to prove this, and his weak, you know, I just can't explain how my DNA's on her. It's just not good enough.
Well, he's banged to rights. There's no way that you could explain that away.
Yeah. And back to Conor Gibson. So he also continued to deny his involvement in his sister's brutal murder. The day before he was arrested, he'd even posted on Facebook, Amber, you will fly high for the rest of time. We will all miss you, especially me. I love you, Ginger Midget. Goodbye for now. Kiss. And hours before he was arrested for her murder, he also shared another post in which he urged the townsfolk to leave a light on for Amber. Conor Gibson was then found guilty after a 13-day trial at the High Court in Glasgow. The judge told him, your sister, the last person she saw was you strangling her. It was depraved and you will pay a heavy price for that. And he also described Gibson's crimes as truly evil. Connor Gibson was jailed for life with a minimum term of 22 years. Amber had such a tragic life, just 16 short years, yet filled with such heartache and such pain. And somehow she was still a really happy and bright young woman. But I'm really sorry, Mark, there is another very sad strand to her story. Just 5 months prior to her murder, Amber suffered a horrific attack at the hands of a man called Jamie Stars. So back in June that same year, Amber had been raped by 20-year-old Jamie Stars, who attacked her after being released on bail for another sex attack. Jamie Stars had violated Amber while she was asleep or unconscious at a property in Bothwell in South Lanarkshire. So during some time in a homeless shelter, Amber reportedly became quite quiet when a discussion turned to a TikTok user who had been falsely accused of rape. And she revealed that this had happened to her. A teenage boy told the staff and the police were called in, and she really bravely spoke to the police. In her statement, she explained, the reason I think I was raped was that I woke up in a bed with no clothes on my bottom half, with a boy I'd only met, naked under the covers. I can't remember hugging him or kissing him at all. Tragically, she would never see her rapist brought to justice because she was killed just weeks after giving her crucial statements to the police. But her testimony supported the trial. So even after her murder, she helped to put Stars away. He was found guilty of raping Amber and also of raping another teenage girl in May 2021 as well. So Jamie Stars was sentenced to 10.5 years in prison, and the judge told him, you have been convicted of appalling crimes against two innocent teenage girls, and you have been assessed as being a very high risk of sexual violence on release. I am required to take into account your age and difficult upbringing. However, the crimes remain serious and grave, and I will impose an extended sentence. He'd also been found guilty of breach of bail conditions and attempting to pervert the course of justice. So as well as those 10.5 years in prison, he has also been placed on the sex offenders register indefinitely.
It's like you said, you know, 16 years old, and Amber's just had the worst life imaginable, hasn't she? She's suffered neglect and abuse at the hands of her own parents. She's been removed from that, put into care, put into foster care. That's not really worked out, placed back into the care system, then raped, then assaulted and murdered by her own brother, the one person who should have absolutely been there to support her because he knew exactly what she'd been through. And then even when she's dead, she's violated again. I don't think we've ever covered anything like this where somebody has, it's just such a tragedy.
I know, it's just awful. And when Laura got in touch with us and said we should cover this case, she kind of described just how there's so little really information out there. Nobody really has covered this case. And yet, what happened to poor Amber? There's just so much. But what really kind of caught my attention when Laura messaged was that she said, I can't remember her phrase exactly, but something along the lines of, even from beyond the grave, even after she died, she was still instrumental in putting away this guy who, you know, potentially his other victim may have been too scared to testify. His other victim may not have wanted to speak out if she didn't have somebody else that was also talking up. Amber's bravery in giving her evidence and testimony then was instrumental in putting this guy behind bars and supporting this other young girl who had been raped by him as well.
And he would have gone on to, he would have carried on. He was a serial sex offender,
rapist. He would have carried on. Yeah, he was already in jail for something else and was released and then went on to do this. So that was what really caught my attention with this, was Laura kind of said, so much happened to her. This happened. But there was still that element of some sort of good ending from the fact that she was still somehow able to support in the prosecution of Jamie Stars. Following the guilty verdict of Connor Gibson for Amber's murder, foster parents Craig and Carol gave a statement and they said, when they arrived at our home, Amber was 3 and Connor aged 5. Connor stated, we are safe. And they were until he took the safety away. Amber deserved to live a life full of hope and opportunities. As a family, we will never be able to get over how this was taken from her. We are relieved that the people involved in what happened to her are now behind bars. However, no amount of time will be justice enough for such an innocent life. As a family, we all feel this could have been prevented. We now have one daughter buried in Larkhall Cemetery and another child in prison. We really miss Amber. Life will never be the same. South Lanarkshire's Child Protection Committee published an independent review into the case, and it made a number of recommendations and identified areas where lessons could be learned. So the report said that both of the children had been seriously affected by the extreme trauma that they had experienced until they were removed from their birth parents' home. They were then fostered by Craig and Carol, and the independent learning review said that all the professionals who worked with Amber and Connor had their health and well-being at the core of their work, and it said they worked hard to engage with both siblings when they were worried about their safety. The report did also highlight that there was no recognised framework, like I said before, about bringing agencies together to manage or to even to assess and then manage young people who were potentially displaying harmful sexual behaviour. So the report recommended that this should be put in place to support early intervention and identify risks. The report noted that both the children struggled to cope with changes to the social workers and the other professionals dealing with them after 2018. So that was around the time that Amber left the Niven home, but there's really not much information about why this was. So whether she left the home because of the changes to the social workers and that's why she went to the care home and that's why Connor remained in the house, I'm not sure, but there was definitely a big change at that point and they both really struggled to kind of cope with those changes,
which is understandable given their background.
So the report concluded that Amber's death could not have been predicted by those involved in the pair's care, but it did identify some practice and organizational learning and it did make a number of recommendations. South Lanarkshire's Director of Health and Social Care said that circumstances of Amber's death were truly terrible and deeply distressing, and he said he welcomed the findings of the learning review and said that all the agencies involved were committed to responding to its improvements and its recommendations. So he said, wherever we can make improvements to the children and the young people in our care, we will strive to do that. So I just didn't really know where to end with this. There was just so much absolute tragedy that happened to Amber. And to be honest, to Connor as well.
Yeah.
Perhaps if that had been identified a lot sooner when his foster parents are saying, look, we can't leave them in the same room as each other, this may well have been very, very different.
Yeah, it seems like, and I know it's easy to say and to look at things with hindsight, but it does seem that there are a lot of learnings off the back of this, and whether there's the resources to implement those learnings is another matter. But there's definitely learnings that young people need much more support if they are being taken out of a traumatic situation, a family home full of neglect, squalor, and placed into the care system or with foster parents. It's an awful lot to cope with at such a young age, and there's going to be a lot of trauma that will manifest later on. So they do need an awful lot of support. You can't just say problem solved. They're with a foster family now. They're out of that situation. That's part of the problem solved, but it's not going to solve everything, is it? So yeah, they need a lot more ongoing support.
Yeah. What an incredible girl though.
Oh, absolutely. But I just, yeah, it's one of those cases I think that will stay with me.
Thank you for joining us this week, everybody. And we will be back next week with another episode of Seeing Red.
We'll see you then.
Bye.
Bye.